Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Israeli assault on Gaza has entered its fourth week. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, over 1,400 Palestinians have been killed, mostly civilians. Over 8,300 have been wounded. Over 400,000 have been displaced. The Israeli army has declared 44% of the Gaza Strip a military, quote, buffer zone. 64 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians have been killed. And today, a 72-hour ceasefire ended after a mere 2 hours. So far today, 40 Palestinians have been killed and an Israeli soldier has reportedly been captured by Hamas. Meantime, the United States has allowed a U.S. arms stockpile located inside of Israel to resupply the Israeli military with grenades and mortar rounds. On July 17th, a consent agreement was unanimously passed in the United States Senate that says, quote, the state of Israel as it defends itself against unprovoked rocket attacks from the Hamas terrorist organization, end quote. Joining us, or actually, we're going to go to Gaza soon, hopefully, to speak with Samer Badawi. He was on our show a couple of weeks ago. He just got to Gaza a couple of days ago, and hopefully we will get a line into Gaza. He's a contributor to 972. That's an online magazine that focuses on events in Israel and Palestine. And then also we're going to talk today about offshore tax havens and corporate tax dodgers. A recent New York Times op-ed quoted the French economist Gabriel Zucman, who estimates conservatively that $7.6 trillion, 8% of the world's personal financial wealth, is stashed in tax havens. He says that if all of this illegally hidden money were properly recorded and taxed, global tax revenues would grow by more than $200 billion a year. These numbers do not include corporate tax dodgers. Walgreens is getting a lot of headlines this week because it might become the latest corporation to merge with a company in Switzerland to avoid paying taxes. Joining us to talk about coverage is Michael Hudson, senior editor with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Michael has been working on ICIJ's groundbreaking investigation of offshore tax havens, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. We are also joined today by Kevin Hall, national economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Hi, Kevin. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us back.
Nice to have you. And we just got a line into Gaza, so I'd like to welcome Samer Badawi to the show. Samer is a contributor to 972 magazine. He just got into Gaza City yesterday. Hi, Samer. I'm glad we were able to connect with you, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Good to talk to you again.
Good to have you on. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a journalist who did a good job this week. So, Kevin, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to go outside the normal news cycle and focus on a story that has kind of been under the radar screen because of all the Russia and Middle Eastern news this week, but my colleague Jonathan Landay at McClatchy and Ali Watkins, my colleagues, did a very thorough piece yesterday on the CIA admissions that it actually has been spying on Senate staffers who are looking into the use of torture and interrogations. That report is coming from Senator Feinstein as early as next week, and it's an ongoing saga that both Jonathan and Ali have been quite involved in for many, many months, and it's a bit of a I told you so, since they were first out of the box in terms of reporting that the CIA had been spying on the Senate. So I think it's in terms of our own democracy, I think it's a very important story, and I hope the readers will find it interesting.
Yeah, well, the lead says an internal CIA investigation confirmed allegations that this happened. What was that process like?
Well, the inspector general within the CIA looked at it and found it. There's a separate investigation going on by the Senate. The sergeant of arms in the Senate, a post that seldom is written about, and then the Senate's own investigation and the CIA's investigation as well. You have a lot of people looking at the same thing, but basically, the CIA now says it in fact did improperly access the emails of Senate staffers. ostensibly to see if they had taken prohibited information or secret information. But for whatever the reasons, they now admit that they did spy on Senate staffers.
So I'm sure that we'll see a lot of investigations in the coming weeks.
Yes, I think this story is just scratched the tip of the iceberg. And another story I had mentioned to your staff as well, Newsweek had a wonderful piece on Gabriel Garcia, the late Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the Colombian author, one of his muses, stepping out of the shadows. Tells a little more of the story about how some of his work was influenced. Not hard-hitting news, but nicely written and a nice read.
Yeah, that thank you for sending over that link. We'll put that on our website right now so listeners can check it out. Thank you for that, Kevin. And what about you, Michael? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to sort of follow Kevin's lead and go a little bit out of the normal news cycle. I'm always fascinated. I mean, I love the news. I read the news every day, but I'm also fascinated by news that sort of creeps and slithers rather than breaks. You know, things that are not part of the daily news diet but affect us in a dramatic way. So one of the things that actually a radio show out of Chicago called This Is Hell by Chuck Mertz interviewed Oliver Berkman, who has a book called The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. And it's just a fascinating book and a fascinating conversation about the sort of positive thinking industry, which sells lots of products to people who are searching for answers. You know, it's people like Dr. Robert Schuller of Crystal Cathedral fame, you know, prosperity gospel kind of advocates. George W. Bush speaks at some of these seminars. And you know, Oliver Berkman's argument is that by trying to be happy, by thinking that we always have to be happy, we end up being less happy. You know, we avoid dealing with some of the difficult realities with life. It doesn't mean you have to go around and be mopey. And he also argues, you know, it has a larger political, which kind of ties back to some of the things we're going to be talking about. It has a larger political implications because this sort of positive thinking ethos is very individualistic. If you're having trouble in your life, it's only your fault. And it sort of discourages you from taking collective action, taking group action, but also discourages you from having a plan B, from understanding, oh, well, this thing I'm going to do, I hope it's going to work, and I've done my best job of you know, trying to game plan it to make it work. But if it doesn't work, I need to have a plan B. But you know, so he would argue that, and I would agree with him, that things like the Iraq War and even the financial crisis, the mortgage meltdown, was partly the result of an excess of positive thinking.
Huh? Interesting. Wow. We should do a show on this.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. We'll find that link and also put that on our website. The radio show, This Is Hell, and the book is The Antidote. Thank you for that, Michael. And Samer, what about you? You just got into Gaza City a couple of days ago, so I know that it's been difficult to get there, and we'll talk to you about that. But what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, Rose, I think I'll have to apologize in advance for the bit of cognitive dissonance here because we're talking about an issue which is obviously very different from what you led with, but I understand. And I would have to say that the best piece I've seen in the last week was written by a reporter for AFP, for the French news agency, by the name of Sarah Hussein. And she wrote a piece upon sort of departure from Gaza after having been here for the first couple of weeks of the war here, that was about seeing the war through the perspective of children. Mm-hmm. And she did a really fantastic job of something that I think we talked about the last time we discussed Gaza on your show, and that is, you know, sort of the empathic role of the reporter and really drawing out the human story. And I think those of us who try to report truthfully and factually from places like this have a hard time figuring out how to do that when we're in the thick of it. And quite often, you know, it takes sort of the distance to be able to have, you know, sort of an analysis and a perspective that allows you to be for lack of a better word, sort of human again.
You know,
and Sarah did a fantastic job of that. Yeah,
I would love for you to elaborate on this, because you just reminded me of Jon Snow, who's a reporter with Channel 4 News in the UK. He has a television show. And The Guardian has a piece called Jon Snow Gaza Video Backed by Channel 4. He did sort of a commentary online and had video of really horrific photos of kids who've been very hurt, including a little girl with these huge black circles around her eyes. Her brain was hit by a shell. And it was a very emotional commentary, and basically said, you know, you care about this. I'm glad you're watching. We're the only ones that can change what's happening. And so they had to defend him, because a lot of people said that it wasn't, quote, balanced. So can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, this issue is getting a lot more attention now, because so many journalists are writing firsthand accounts of what they're seeing.
Right. Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. Did you mean for us to talk about it now? Or
yeah, now, since later, you brought it up. Now would be great.
Yeah, sure. Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, this is probably the only sort of conflict situation that I know of in the world where fully one-third of the casualties, and by that I mean those killed, are children. And we're not talking about children here who are dying as sort of quote-unquote collateral damage. These are children who live with their parents in a part of the world where 80% of the people live below the poverty line, and, you know, out of the 1.8 million people, 70 to 75% of them are actually refugees, which means they live in refugee camps. And, you know, these children, as you noted, these children are being killed by in some cases, one-ton bombs that are being dropped by F-16s, by artillery shells that are fired mercilessly throughout the day, and especially when the sun goes down. And by the way, I should note to you and to your listeners that you might actually hear a few of them as we're on this conversation, because the sun did, in fact, just go down here in Gaza. So, you know, ignoring that side of the story, I mean, the fully one-third of the children are the casualties, and their injuries are horrific, would be not only a disservice, but it would also be, I think, unprofessional. You know, I don't think that by reporting on the fact that, you know, a six-year-old girl, for example, let me just give you one example here that is quite.
Oh, we lost Samer. That Samer Badawi is joining us from Gaza, and the phone lines, as you can imagine, are pretty bad at the moment. We'll try to get him right back. Michael, I wanted to ask you about this, because you're a heavy Twitter user, and social media, we often hear this, but I think this time around, social media is really allowing us to learn about what's happening in real time. And, you know, what are your thoughts about journalists really telling the story from more of an emotional perspective, especially when we're talking about children who are being killed and wounded?
You know, it's difficult, because you talk about, you know, the reporters in the field, you know, they're on the ground, so they have some control over what they're reporting and what their stories say, but ultimately, you know, they're relying on their editors back home. And, you know, and it's a, you know, if you're sitting back home in New York or London or wherever, you know, you're not seeing what's happening directly. And you may want to say, well, that, okay, we'll report this, but let's not overdo it, because this would seem like we're taking sides. And so, I mean, one of my fears is that a lot of this is stuff is getting screened out in the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. Not completely, of course, but and reporters in the field take their tips. Like, they may try to get stuff like that into their stories, but after it gets cut out sort of consistently or cut out to some degree, they start to push less, because, you know, there's only so much time in a day, and they can't be fighting with their editors all the time. They ultimately just have to provide what they're being asked to provide. And when they get these signals that, oh, you know, okay, don't overdo it, don't go too far, and I've always worried about that, because I've had editors say that, and it's never don't go farther than the facts take you. It's just, oh, don't go too far, you know, based on this sort of imaginary invisible fence of proper discourse, don't overdo it.
Well, I mean, if you were an editor in this case, and, you know, you had a reporter who saw kids being killed on a beach, what would you say to the reporter? What don't go. I mean, what does it mean when you say don't go too far in that case?
Right. No. Well, I think you report the facts as you see them on the ground, and tell us what happened as best you can. And of course, if I'm an editor, I want other reporting too, because you know the reporter's only going to be seeing what's happening at that moment. But we want more context in the story. But I want to hear it all. I want you to dig. I want you to tell me that human story, and as difficult as it is to tell, and as hard as it is for people to read. But we need to know that.
Kevin, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, if I could jump in. A friend of mine is actually in Gaza and has done some fantastic reporting. Precisely on that, you know, people killed on the beach and things of that sort, Nick Casey from the Wall Street Journal. And he's done a lot of blogging and a lot of video from there over the last week. And he's taken some heat, and I've certainly shared every on my own social media things that he's done. And it's funny to get the feedback where people say, well, you know, they'll repost something else and say, well, here's balance. But it's not a question of balance. He's simply telling what happened on the scene there. He's not picking sides, he's showing what happened. So it's actually interesting that social media allows you to take a reader somewhere that your story generally doesn't, and in ways your story can't. I noticed our own national security and Middle East folks are very active in sending around photos from the scenes. Most papers won't run these graphic photos. We won't even run them on our website. But it is being sent around on Twitter, on Facebook, and I think people are getting a clearer picture of the consequence of what's going on there in a way that our stories don't necessarily make clear, if that makes sense.
So let me ask you both this then, as we're trying to reconnect with Samer Badawi in Gaza. Because both of you have colleagues who are in Gaza and you're seeing real-time photos and videos of what's happening, how does that compare with the reporting that you're seeing and hearing, especially in the U.S. media? Kevin? Like the networks, for example. How does that compare?
Yeah, I think the problem, I guess, and this will show my own newspaper bias, but I think the networks have a bigger challenge if you're talking about the evening news. They're trying to tell the story with limited space. If you're talking about the long shows, the CNN, the MSNBC, the Fox, you know, unfortunately, that's become so bifurcated to points of view that I'm not sure, my own personal opinion is I'm not sure it's terribly useful to do anything other than cement the views people already have. In terms of the newspaper reporting, I think it's been pretty straightforward. I think what is so vexing about the Gaza is this is, you know, a perennial problem that has exploded again, and you know, there are no solutions to it. If there were, we wouldn't be back here every X number of years, unfortunately.
That is Kevin Hall, national economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Michael Hudson is senior editor with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and we just managed to reconnect with Gaza. And we're speaking with Samer Badawi, a contributor to 972, an online magazine offering reporting and analysis of events in Israel and Palestine. He just got into Gaza City yesterday. And Samer, since we lost you, what is it like there in terms of phone connections, electricity, water? Can you give us an assessment of just basic necessities in Gaza?
Yeah, I can tell you that it's quite the juggling act. Most people in Gaza now actually have little to no access to electricity. In terms of the public utility, they actually have zero. And then for those who happen to live in apartment buildings, on occasion they'll have a sort of diesel supply that the owner of the building or the people who sort of rent it collectively can turn on for several hours a day as they sort of ration out the diesel, because there's obviously that's impossible to get in now, and it's also for the majority of the day it's actually very dangerous to be driving around and delivering that. So that's in terms of electricity. In terms of water, you may have seen the UN report that said that Gaza will actually be, by the year 2020, uninhabitable. And a huge part of the reason for that is the fact that the water supply is severely polluted. Mm. And so the place where I'm staying right now, we actually have a fairly decent supply of it, but I can tell you that we're being very careful especially, you know, not knowing when this when the events will end. And then, you know, in terms of phone connection, the Israelis have threatened on and off over the last 3 weeks to cut off the network here. And my suspicion is that it's because of people, you know, reporting from here that that's not happening, because I think it would be very difficult for them to justify cutting off journalists from the rest of the world. And then obviously it affects the ability to connect online as well.
You just got into Gaza City yesterday. What was it like for you to get there?
It was a bureaucratic mess. You know, the Israelis have been very circumspect about the procedures for getting in and out, and you have to coordinate with the military here at the what's called the Erez checkpoint, which is the only way in and out of Gaza, and it's controlled by the Israelis. And you basically don't know from one day to the next whether or not it will be open. In my case, it had been closed, I believe, for 2 days prior to an email that I received from them saying that I was to show up at, you know, a particular time the very next day. When I got there, I was joined by about 40 other journalists, put on a bus and driven into Gaza City. And then prior to doing so, we were all made to sign a piece of paper that basically absolved the Israeli Defense Forces of any responsibility for our safety while we're here, which is a bit of a bit of an irony because of the fact that, you know, if something were to happen to us, it would be precisely because of the IDF.
Now you've been to Afghanistan and Iraq during wartime summer. Have you had to sign a similar document there in Iraq and Afghanistan?
No, I absolutely have not.
This is unusual.
This is highly unusual, and I think what adds to the fact that it's unusual is that Israel, you know, likes to claim that it has no control over the Gaza Strip, that it's no longer occupied. And yet, you know, the only way for me to get here, by the way, I should mention, I am myself a Palestinian American. The only way that I could get here was with permission from the Israeli government. And so that says something about the sort of contradictory nature of their claim to not be occupying the Gaza Strip.
And that is Samer Badawi. He's a contributor to 972 magazine. We're also joined by Kevin Hall with McClatchy, Michael Hudson with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. I'm thinking we might lose you again. So, Kevin and Michael, do you have any questions for Samer before we let him go? Kevin?
We're going to let Michael go first.
Oh, Michael?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yes, Samer. Just, I mean, tell me. You know, how much danger is there for journalists in this situation? I know the main danger is for civilians and combatants, but as we've seen around the world, there's a growing number of journalists who are being killed, captured, and harmed, both in battle zones and outside of battle zones. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say that having been to Iraq and Afghanistan and a couple of other places that that are not exactly friendly to journalists, this is the only place that I have ever been where you have this combination of lethal power hovering over you 24 hours a day. The sound, the sort of low hum of a drone is a constant sound that one hears. The F-16s overhead, the missile strikes, and most importantly, the artillery shelling. And that's where, you know, the answer to your question really lies, because anyone who knows anything about that knows that it really is quite random. And so when you're talking about, you know, for example, the owner of a hotel right on the beach, not far from a hotel which I will not name for obvious reasons, where many journalists are actually staying, was sent, you know, this sort of infamous message by the IDF saying you must evacuate the building because we intend to target it.
And Samer, hold that thought. Sorry to cut you off, but we're going to take a quick break, and hopefully we'll continue with getting a good line to Gaza. That's Samer Badawi with 972. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. Or you can post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org. where you will also find links related to today's Media Roundtable program. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say, and at noon today, it's the Tavis Smiley Show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about the sharing economy. How would you define it today? The shareable economy includes for-profit companies like Airbnb, Lyft, and TaskRabbit. Do you think that these are really sharing companies? What's the original mission of the sharing economy, and what do you think it should look like? That's Monday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We're joined by Kevin Hall, national economics correspondent for McClatchy, Michael Hudson, senior editor with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and Samer Badawi. He's a contributor to 972. That's an online magazine offering on-the-ground reporting by Israelis and Palestinians of events in Israel and Palestine. Samer just got into Gaza City yesterday, and we're hoping that we have a decent line with him for the next few minutes. If you have a question for Samer about what he's seen or any questions about reporting, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And Samer, you did tweet that you've been to Afghanistan and Iraq, and you've never heard this combination of deadly weapons unleashed over civilian areas. You were just talking about the hotel you're staying in, and the owner received a phone call? Or receive some kind of warning?
It's not a hotel that I'm staying in, but it's a hotel that is not far from my location.
Oh, okay.
And that does house several journalists. It also happens to be within 500 meters of two other hotels that are housing the majority of journalists who are reporting from here. And yes, that's exactly what happened. Basically, the owner of the hotel received a text message from the IDF informing him that they intended to target the hotel and that he should take precautions. Now, ordinarily, if you're talking about a Palestinian home, that basically means that you have anywhere from, 3 minutes to 5 minutes to run as far as you can from the house so as to not be killed. In the case of this hotel, presumably the IDF is taking extra precautions, and so far nothing has happened to it. And I don't know the reason for the text message. No one ever knows why the IDF chooses to target homes or hotels. But that's really just part of the threat that the journalists face here. And, I just want to remind your listeners, because this is what we were talking about before the break, I think it's really the shelling, it's the tanks and the artillery fire that everyone fears most of. So random.
According to the Man News Agency, 9 Palestinian journalists have been killed so far. Kevin, before we let Samer go, do you have a question for him?
Yeah, a comment and a question. I guess one of the things that's striking, as he was very eloquently laying out, is kind of the trap in which the people in Gaza are in. There is no escape. You've got the ocean, you've got Israel. I mean, they're sort of sitting ducks in a way, and it's certainly why there's always collateral damage. But I guess what's striking is, in when we've had these things in the past, there's been some balance. The U.S. hasn't been kind of the sole arbiter, and I guess it's striking right now how there really is nobody diplomatically stepping into the void. And the U.S. isn't seen, certainly in the Arab world, as a neutral broker. But given the conflict with Russia, the Chinese are absent in this, I guess it's striking to me how little balance there is to the U.S. position in the global stage. And I'm wondering if your guest feels that on the ground. Do people say that? Is there a hope that some other end power gets involved in this?
I think, is it Mike? Is that who I'm speaking with?
It's Kevin Hall.
Okay, pardon me, Kevin. So, Kevin, I think there are a couple of things I want to mention. First is that when I was in the eastern part of Gaza today, walking in a place called Shujaiya, which witnessed one of the most horrific spells of shelling over the course of a couple of days and displaced tens of thousands of individuals, I literally found an RPG that said Made in the USA on it. And so the first sort of point to be made here is that you know, Palestinians know full well that the Americans, were they to step in, are not an honest broker in this. What the Americans are the funders and the backers of what Israel is doing to the civilian population right now. And what Palestinians expect of the U.S. government and of President Obama is not so much to step in and negotiate anything, but to say to the Israelis in a way that is consistent with the entire international community and with human rights observers and activists throughout the world, that what they are doing is wrong by targeting civilian populations. There is no collateral damage here. There have been homes deliberately targeted. There have been hospitals that have been deliberately targeted. There have been schools that have been deliberately targeted. So far, six of them, two of them housing some of the 250,000 internally displaced people from the east of Gaza, massacring hundreds of people. What President Obama needs to step in and do is not so much broker anything, but say to Benjamin Netanyahu that, look, if you don't cut this out, we're going to stop. Did you hear that?
Yes, you're fine.
Okay, all right. I was wondering if you just heard the incoming shell.
Oh, but, no, I'm sorry. I thought you wondered if we heard you. No, I didn't hear that shell.
That's okay, no problem. But, yeah, I mean, the issue here is that the U.S. is the only government on the planet right now that can stop what Benjamin Netanyahu is doing. And what it needs to do is take a very forceful approach with that, because we as Americans hold basically the purse that is funding what is happening in Gaza today.
Well, Samer, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll definitely have you on again soon. And if you want to follow Samer on Facebook and Twitter, we will put links on yourcallradio.org, and he's posting live updates. Thank you so much, Samer.
Thank you for having me, girls.
Thank you. You too. That is Samer Badawi. He just got into Gaza City yesterday. He's reporting on the ground for 972. That's an online magazine offering on-the-ground reporting by Israelis and Palestinians of events in Israel and Palestine. And Kevin, before we move on from this topic, I did want to ask you about this angle, the question that you brought up about the United States. Reuters had a piece called U.S. Resupplies Israel with Munitions as Gaza Offensive Rages. It seems like this is starting to get more attention. And the leads basically say, as President Obama publicly condemns, in some cases, these shellings, they're allowing Israel to tap local U.S. arms stockpilers inside Israel for more grenades and mortar rounds. Since you're in Washington, is this getting much attention? Are people talking about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's... It's a tough issue, as your guest had mentioned. I mean, I think the fact that it has conflict on each side, I think, is weighed on the Congress. But I know in private conversations, there's been a lot of pressure on Obama to precisely do that, to find ways to pressure Israel without doing so publicly, because I think that's one of the issues, and we're in the middle of an election cycle. But I do think CNBC had also broken in this morning with some breaking news that just that it's not new exports, it's using arms that are in Israel at a U.S. facility.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's a resupply, and I think that it's a fair question. There is pressure. You don't see it publicly, though. I think that itself is subject for discussion.
The Senate Appropriations Committee also added $225 million for Iron Dome to a spending bill, mainly to provide money to handle, to deal with the children coming over the border. But I believe that died recently, just yesterday, right?
As part of the broader issue,
I think
it died on its own.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then, Michael, we've got a question from Cornelius, who points to an op-ed in the New York Times last Sunday about the absence of long-term foreign correspondents on the ground impacting the news and perspective we receive. And Cornelius says, what are your thoughts on how much this contributes to the labeling of recent events in Gaza as, quote, fighting between two equal sides instead of an Israeli military assault? How does the lack of long-term foreign correspondents affect the coverage?
Well, it just, you know, you can't cover a conflict from afar. You've got to have some journalists on the ground, and a lot of papers have pulled back. You know, the Philadelphia Inquirer was, you know, is a good newspaper. At one point, it was a great newspaper, and it had lots of foreign correspondents. I believe right now it has none or just a handful, and I think that's true. You know, I think the New York Times still has a lot of people out there. But I think in general, you're finding that the major U.S. media, which is, you know, supposed to be telling us, you know, what's going on in the world, have really pulled back from covering international affairs. They're relying on, to some degree, relying on CNN and a few other international news outlets to tell them what's going on rather than sending someone there to find out.
Kevin?
I think the economics have weighed on it. We have
Absolutely.
Four bureaus. We're one of the few organizations that still does. We have Istanbul, China, Mexico. We've got five. Forgive me for not remembering all off the top of my head, and we do have people in region. And it does make a difference having veteran people. And I think what a lot of news organizations, including us, are doing is a lot of us have come back to Washington, myself a former correspondent. But you can get back in there and report for a couple weeks and get out. We have Jonathan Lande going in and out of places, Hannah Allen going in and out of places, Nancy Youssef. But there's also an amount of exhaustion. I mean, people's budgets are getting blown to bits because we've had Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Egypt, and now this again. This is kind of a repeat, but we've got all these other things. It's been a really unusual period of demand for foreign coverage at a time when everybody's revenues are shrinking drastically.
And you know, I have to say, I mean, it's hard for even great journalists like in McClatchy. It's hard to go in for 2 weeks and really be able to tell everything you know. You can tell, I think, most foreign journalists obviously would rather have much more time on the ground, be you know, stationed permanently or semi-permanently in places, but just the economics mean that can't happen. I mean, what ICIJ, my shop does, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, is we sort of try to reverse this sort of parachute journalism where Western journalists or U.S. journalists go in for brief periods and come out and report by working with people on the ground who are already there. And, you know, who already have sources, already know what's going on. But it's difficult, you know, that even that can be difficult because often you're talking about people who are in danger, who are under real pressure not to report certain things or not to go certain places with their story. So it's always difficult. And I think we need a combination of supporting foreign journalists who are based in places around the world and relying on them, but also sending good U.S. reporters out there to collaborate with them and work with them and do stuff that's complementary. So
several have died on the job in the last 5 years, too, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Well, this piece in the New York Times is The Media's Retreat from Foreign Reporting by Anjan Sundaram. He's author of Stringer, A Reporter's Journey in Congo, talking about how he was one of about three journalists in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Today we are speaking with Kevin Hall, National Economics Correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and Michael Hudson, Senior Editor with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thanks again for the email, Cornelius. And let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go to Max. Hi, Max.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call and for a good program as usual. I enjoy your programs on Friday morning. And there's such wide-ranging programs. I find that very useful. I've been following with some fascination an interesting story that has to do with the financial travail of Argentina, having to do with some sort of a final settlement on relating to a default that took place some 10 years ago. But what I find extraordinary is simply that a sovereign country of some 40 million people is at the mercy, in terms of its financial future, at the mercy of the decision of a judge in New York City. I wish that Mr. Hall would address that, but certainly I would encourage you to have a story on that the next time you have the opportunity. Thank you very much. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you. Kevin?
Sure, I'd love to jump at that. I had the good fortune of actually covering the collapse in 2001 from the region, so it's an issue that's near and dear to my heart. The answer I'll give may not be what the caller was looking for. I don't really think Argentina's at the mercy of the banks. I think they had all kinds of alternatives to this. What bothers the Argentines is that these are the so-called vulture funds that people bought up distressed debt and are trying to collect on it, and it kind of goes to a bigger issue of the judge ruled on an issue that was more of a kind of a straightforward rule of law issue. Argentina has $30 billion in reserves. This isn't something that is going to break Argentina. They've made a conscious decision to make a stand, but they've been pretty much locked out of the financial system since 2001. And they're kind of a unique case because they, when I was covering that crisis at the time, their response was basically, it's your fault you lent us the money. And that still seems to be the argument 13 years later. And very little, I would not have believed when I covered that crisis, and my photographer at the time told me, you watch when the middle class gets its money back, this will go away. And I thought for sure something new would come out of the ashes, but in fact, the same chronic politicians, the same people who run the country, the same cliques that have run the country for so long are still, you know, firmly in power. So I'm not terribly sympathetic to the Argentines. I think it's a choice of their own making. They're not a Bolivia or an Ecuador or a country that's very poor. They're a country that has every reason to be much more successful than it is.
Mm. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Max. Let's talk now about offshore tax havens and corporate tax dodgers. Michael, you were part of a massive investigation for more than 2 years on offshore tax havens. Over at your website, the headlines, How the UK's Rich Exploit Loophole, America's Own Island Haven, Manhattan, Leaking Records Reveal Offshore Holdings of China's Elite. I mean, you had so many stories involved in this series. What has really changed since so much of this information has been exposed?
I think what has changed is that there have been a lot of promises, new promises, new vows that we're going to crack down, we're going to change things. Europe certainly has started a process of pushing harder to deal with offshore-enabled tax evasion. What hasn't changed at this point have been the policies and rules and laws. There's a lot of talk, and we've had these sort of cycles in the past of presidents and prime ministers promising to do something, and then there's a flurry of activity, and then nothing comes of it. So right now we're sort of in the middle of this process right now, but we don't know if the European Union, we don't know if the other international organizations are really going to follow through.
Kevin, what are your thoughts on this? The ICIJ investigation got so much attention once it launched. And what are your thoughts on what has changed and what hasn't changed?
I guess my first thought is never underestimate the power of inertia. We've seen it on so many things. Things have changed at the margins on certain countries, certainly has changed. Michael's reporting, I think, has in some countries has been just completely, you know, an earthquake, a political earthquake, and has changed the status quo in a lot of ways. But in terms of on the international stage, creating new rules, nothing happens, unfortunately, fast in any international forum. And I think the more functional way it will happen is, you know, country by country, not an international court, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, and I think that really is the problem, because the way the offshore system works is it's not like one-to-one. Oh, well, you've got somebody in the U.S. hiding their money in the British Virgin Islands or et cetera. You know, it's a very complex web. Often you'll find that when people are trying to move money surreptitiously, you know, they have a company in the British Virgin Islands, which is owned by a trust in Singapore, which is controlled by an anonymous company in Cyprus, and so it's hard for one country to really do anything. The only way to make change would be for lots of big countries, and especially the U.S. and the U.K., folks that are sort of the choke points in the global financial system, to really get serious and do something. It's a little bit of a whack-a-mole. As soon as you crack down on one, there's been somewhat of a crackdown on the British Virgin Islands, partly because our story's focused on the BVI, but now other other offshore havens like the Seychelles and the Indian Ocean have actually been picking up business.
Wow.
Because there are fewer companies, offshore companies being created in the BVI now, so there are other places that are benefiting from this.
Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, if I could piggyback on that, I mean, even before Michael's reporting, there had been attempts to do some of that with places like Nauru, if I'm pronouncing that right, in the South Pacific, and some of these places that were the most egregious. But I think the motivation had been more about terror finance and the potential for terrorists to use these sort of or other nefarious purposes versus simply hiding money. That had been the focus. Michael knows a lot more about this than I do, but my sense is that most of the interest from our government on this has been really trying to crack down on international crime syndicates and not so much money laundering. And the money laundering part has been focused heavily on Switzerland and trying to bring the Swiss banks to their knees for hiding U.S. assets. Is that right, Michael?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And one of the key things to remember here is that this is not just a story about, oh, look at the bad Swiss or look at the bad folks in the Caymans. They're, you know, everybody's involved. The U.S. in its own way is a tax haven. One of the stories we have recently is about how wealthy people, politicians, organized criminals and folks are buying high-end Manhattan real estate as a way of sort of laundering their money and also enjoying the fruits of their looting. And there's really no, in New York State or really throughout the United States, there's no legal mechanism. Real estate agents are not required to report suspicious transactions. They basically have been exempted from the Patriot Act, while bankers and securities brokers and people like that have new stringent requirements on them about anti-money laundering policies. The Treasury Department has exempted the real estate industry. So that's just an example of how big countries like the U.S. and the U.K. are participating in this system. So to some degree, we have to clean up our act in addition to working to force other countries to make changes.
A lot of the drug money, just as an aside, ends up in white, what they call white goods, refrigerators, washing machines, big ticket items that are sold all over Latin America. And that's how some of that drug money gets laundered. General Electric, Whirlpool, U.S. companies that export this. So Michael's absolutely right that you know we do a lot of this ourselves.
Also, Walgreens is making big headlines this week. The country's largest drugstore chain. They've got more than 8,500 stores, and they are going to decide whether to take advantage of a loophole in tax law that would allow the corporation to save billions of dollars by moving headquarters to Europe. It's on the verge of acquiring controlling interest in Alliance Boots. That's a Swiss-based company that operates drugstores in the UK. And according to reports, Walgreens' tax rate would be cut to 20% from 31% now. Walgreens brings in $72 billion in revenue directly from the government. It received almost $17 billion from Medicare and Medicaid last year. And according to Americans for Tax Fairness, this costs U.S. taxpayers about $4 billion over 5 years. Kevin, what are your thoughts on the reporting on this? Because we're hearing about a lot of U.S. corporations now that are going to merge with overseas corporations so they don't have to pay taxes.
I think the reporting has been very good. I would caution that it's not really a loophole in the law. The law simply allows it, and people are taking advantage of that. It's been sometimes characterized as a loophole, but it isn't taking advantage of, you know, X chapter of the tax code. It's simply moving their operation abroad, moving their headquarters abroad, while still doing most of their business here. There's no prohibition on that. It's happened for decades, but at a slower pace. What's new now is it's one of the ways companies, one of the reasons you're seeing corporate profits so high, are people looking at ways to continue being more effective in profit and shareholder return, and this is one of them. What the president proposed in his latest budget proposal earlier this year was putting a cap on that. So if you're going to do that, you're going to move to Ireland or the Netherlands or wherever you're going to move, if you move less than 50% of your of your operations there, you're still going to be taxed like a U.S. company. You're not going to be treated as a foreign entity. And so what they're trying to do is raise that threshold. And I think that's where the discussion is on the Democratic side in Congress. Ironically, Republicans were the ones who really first pushed on this issue, Charles Grassley, Orrin Hatch. And it's not an issue that that Republicans are necessarily opposed to, because I think both sides somewhat see it as a patriotism issue. But now in today's political environment, there's chance of anything getting done is pretty slim.
And Michael, we've got about a minute left. You've done exhaustive work on this issue, and it's a pretty complicated issue spanning across the globe. How do you make this palatable for ordinary citizens to understand this?
You know, I think what ordinary citizens do understand this. I think they understand the idea, well, you know, April 15th, I mean, I'm paying, depending on what state you're in, you know, I'm paying, you know, 15 to 30% of my income to the government. And yet we hear about these, you know, what the, you know, what corporations are paying, what wealthy investors are paying, and they're paying often a fraction of that in taxes. And so I think people understand that.
And,
but whether or not politicians will you know, take action, I mean, because they have two constituents. They have the voters, but then they also have their campaign contributors who may have a different view of this.
Right. What are you working on right now, Michael?
We are working on more. I can't say too much detail, but we're working on more offshore stories. We have continued to, you know, we got the big leak, which been called hashtag offshore leaks, but we've been getting subsequent leaks too, and we just published a lot of stuff from the Channel Island of Jersey about celebrities and politicians who are, you know, hiding their money through bank accounts there. You know, secreting their money there.
And Kevin, just quickly, what are you working on?
Oh, we run of the gamut. We're taking a deeper dive on the consumer and trying to understand what's going on with the consumer in today's economy. But I use my last seconds to really heap praise on Michael. I think the work they've done is extraordinary, and I think it is the benefit of all our citizens.
Kevin Hall is economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and Michael Hudson is senior editor with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Thank you both for joining us. Thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How would you define the sharing economy today? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the transformation of the shareable economy with the explosion of for-profit companies like Airbnb, Lyft, and TaskRabbit. Big investors and venture capitalists are backing these companies. So who's investing? What's the original mission of the sharing economy, and what should it look like? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.